Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you believe you're too smart to fall for a scam, you're probably wrong. I believe the same thing, also wrong. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The trouble is that a good con artist, or make that skillful con artist, does not just pick victims at random. They're looking for people who want to believe their stories. And you and me, we want to believe. Maria Konnikova is a writer with a PhD in psychology and a fascination with the aspects of human nature that make even very bright people susceptible to scams. Her new book explains the science and introduces seemingly ordinary people who have pulled off some incredibly audacious scams. It's called The Confidence Game: Why We Fall For It Every Time. Maria, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Reading this book, I realized that I love stories of con artists, movies and novels and news accounts. It's never that I'm happy to hear that somebody got swindled. It's just that the people who pull these crimes off seem almost supernaturally clever. Are they?
They do seem that way, and they are absolutely fascinating. As for whether or not they're supernaturally clever, they certainly are clever. I think a lot of them are incredibly intelligent, talented people who, had they chosen a more legitimate profession, would have done incredibly well at it. But they've chosen to go in a different direction. And what strikes me about them is that a lot of the things they do have striking parallels to the things that we do in the real world in far less fascinating and far less criminal circumstances.
Well, give us some examples of that.
Sure. So they are the best storytellers that you will ever meet. And well, in my profession as a writer, I realize that's the exact same thing I do. I tell stories, I weave narratives, I create characters for people to empathize with. I create new worlds for people, and that's what they do, except I hope that I don't do it for nefarious ends. I hope I do it to illuminate science, to illuminate interesting stories, and they do it to create an alternate reality so that you give them your confidence and you end up parting with your money, your reputation, whatever it is that they're after.
So maybe there's a subset of the population, and I guess we can assume writers might be part of this, who could imagine a con that would work, right, that would make a great story. But am I just naive about this? How is it that cons get over the hurdle of their conscience to harm people who in most cases have done nothing to them? This is not revenge on somebody. It's usually just picking out an innocent person who looks like they would fall for it.
Absolutely. And I tried to explore what it is psychologically that makes con artists who they are. And I found literature on the so-called dark triad of traits that seems to capture a lot of con artists. And the dark triad consists of three characteristics, obviously. The first is psychopathy, or a lack of conscience, a lack of empathy. So you don't experience emotion in the same way as regular people do, and so you don't feel bad for the victims because you lack that capacity to empathize with what they're going through. The other part of it is a sense of narcissism. So you not only have an overblown sense of self, but you also have a huge sense of entitlement. I have something owed to me. This is coming to me. And so I don't feel bad taking it from you because it's rightly mine. I deserve it. And finally, you have something called Machiavellianism. And this comes from Machiavelli's The Prince. And it's the ability to use the tools of persuasion to get people to do your bidding, to get them to perform as you want for your own ends. And con artists are obviously incredibly talented at doing this because that's the way that they get people to hand them money, to hand them love, hand them reputation, whatever it is that they're after.
Okay, hand them love is really interesting. A lot of people think about confidence games that are about stealing large amounts of money. Of course, like Bernie Madoff comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Others, though, are harder to explain. It seems that there are some people who just thrive on passing themselves off as somebody else.
Absolutely. I think a lot of them thrive on a sense of power over others. I mean, it's a huge rush to know that you're affecting people's realities, that you are changing what they believe about the world, that you have some sort of a power and control over their minds. You know, it's a little bit like playing God. And there are some con artists in the book that did that much more literally. There's one that I read about, Ferdinand Waldo Demara, who played a surgeon. He never even finished high school, but ended up not just becoming assigned to a ship during the Korean War by the Canadian Navy, but being the only surgeon on board. And then he had the nerve to perform surgery. So this guy cut people open, and he didn't even have a high school degree.
And he had like, I laugh about it now, but he had like a cheat sheet, basically, that he, between procedures, he was running in and flipping through this book that he'd made for himself.
Absolutely. So he had conned doctors before he went on this ship. And he said, hey, you know, we might get ourselves into combat situations where the soldiers don't have me right next to them. Don't you think it would be a good idea to have a field guide for the troops so that they know what to do if something horrible goes wrong so that they aren't completely helpless? And the doctors said, oh, what a wonderful idea. And he said, well, let me defer to your expertise, doctor. You know, you've been at this so much longer than I have. You're so good at what you do. I admire you so much. And so what did the other doctors do? They wrote this field guide, theoretically with input from Demara, but really he obviously had nothing to do with it because he had buttered them up so well they didn't even notice. And so off he went with a basic medical textbook and this field guide and lots of antibiotics. He learned very early on that antibiotics were his best friend. And he also had this remarkable thing where if he couldn't cure someone, if someone were really, really sick, he basically hid them in a separate part of the ship so that the numbers didn't count against him.
Wow. You mentioned flattery. That's a very important tool in the con artist's kit. Because when somebody tells us something amazing about ourselves, we are inclined to believe it and therefore to believe everything else they tell us.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where it need not even start with flattery. It can start with something as small as remembering our name. Mm. Con artists are so good at those minor details because if someone remembers our name, we like them so much more because we say, oh, you know, you're actually a very discerning and smart person because out of all the things to remember, you chose to remember my name. And my name is obviously incredibly important because I'm an incredibly important human being. And so we feel flattered just by virtue of that minor interaction. And right away we say, you know, this is a good, smart guy. I think I should trust him. And it only goes forward from there.
How often do con artists, based on the stories that you have investigated, sort of go into it thinking, I'm going to become a con artist? And how often do they fall into it sort of accidentally and then realize that they can get away with a lot?
I think most of them end up falling into it accidentally, and it's not necessarily that they didn't mean to be a con artist. It's that they found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time for becoming a con artist. And so they were already predisposed. They had either some or all of that dark triad of traits that we've talked about. But then the kind of that moment happens. They find themselves, for instance, in a company that really looks the other way, where there's a permissive environment, and they find themselves losing a little bit of money. So they start fudging the books a little bit, and lo and behold, they get away with it. And before you know it, they're full-fledged con artists. Someone like Ferdinand Demara had a lot of personal difficulties. So his family used to be incredibly well off. Then his father lost his job. They had to move to a very poor part of town. His sister died. A lot of things happened. And so he wanted to preserve that same status and reputation that he'd had before. And he started conning his classmates in school so that they thought that he still had the money that he used to. And he got away with it. And that was kind of his first con. So I think it's a little bit of both, that you are predisposed, because not everyone in those circumstances would right away turn to deception. But if you have that predisposition and the chips fall in the right way and you get away with it, well, then why, you know, why do anything else?
So one of the things that shocks us about stories of con artists is how they just lie and lie and lie and then, you know, weave this web of deception. And I was thinking about it, reading this book and thinking, I'm a terrible liar. And yet, you point out we all lie more than we will acknowledge to ourselves, which in itself is a kind of lie. For example, I don't think I'm a very good liar in terms of telling you something I didn't do last night that I actually did. But I could probably convince you that, you know, your sweater doesn't make you look lumpy.
Absolutely. And society really functions on white lies that we tell each other and ourselves all the time. I mean, we would hate the person who each time we asked, how are you doing today, gave us an honest answer.
Right. We don't want to know. Right.
No, we don't actually want to know that you're tired, that you didn't sleep well, that your head's bothering you. We don't want to know any of that. We want you to say, oh, I'm great. How are you? And move on. And so these types of things, it's social grace. It really facilitates interactions and it makes us feel better. You know, if I am tired, I'd love for you to say, hey, Maria, you look great today.
Right.
You know, did you do something different with your hair? I don't want you to say, ooh, rough night last night.
Right. It's funny, though, because it occurs to me that we're even lying when we ask somebody, not always, but we're often lying when we ask somebody, how are you? It's just a greeting. We're hoping that they won't tell us.
Absolutely. We don't care. And oftentimes, you know, obviously we're not all terrible people. We want everyone to be doing well, but we don't actually care. We have our own worries. We have our own concerns. We don't want to know how every single one of our coworkers or the people we meet at the coffee shop, we don't want to know how they're doing, but we ask these questions and we tell these minor lies, minor deceptions that really make life much more pleasant. And we're the type of person who other people want to have around because we're nice and everything works much better. And the flip side of it, of course, is that we are pretty bad at detecting those lies because it's better not to. I want to believe that I look really good today, not that I look tired. It makes me happier. So I choose to believe it.
So there may be some things we don't care about, but most of us who are not sociopaths have empathy. And con artists recognize that triggering that empathy is like their ticket in the front door.
Absolutely. There is nothing that they love more than getting you emotionally involved in their story. And that is what they always do. Sometimes it's a sob story. So, for instance, there's one con artist who I write about in the book, Gary Lyon, who used to basically tell strangers that his car had run out of gas. And if someone just told you, I need money for gas, you would say, oh, really? Where's your car? You know, how much money do you need? You'd start asking all sorts of questions, right? Hmm. But he would say, my daughter has cancer. She's in the hospital. I'm late for the surgery. My car just ran out of gas. You really have to help me out. What would people do? They'd hand over the money. Right. Because what are they going to say? Give me your cancer records? You know, I need proof. Is your daughter really in the hospital? We don't do that. We feel terrible for this guy. We want to help him get to the hospital. Right away, that story makes us want to help out.
And what's interesting is that, and I'm not condoning this kind of deception or crime, but what's interesting about it is that in the second scenario, we walk away from that maybe with our wallets, you know, $10 or $20 lighter, but we feel great for the rest of the day. Whereas if we just give this shifty looking guy money because he claims his car ran out of gas, we suspect for the rest of the day that we have been taken.
Absolutely. And that is something that con artists are so good at. They make us feel like we're really good human beings. So there are some cons where people say, well, why in the world would you fall for that? What's in it for you? You know, you're not getting any financial return. It's not like a sweetheart scam where you're finding a love interest. You're just getting nothing. So why in the world would you give this person money? You are getting something. You're getting a sense of yourself as not just a decent human being, but as someone who is making the world a better place. And that gives you a warm glow. Everyone wants to feel that way.
Maria Konnikova is my guest. She's a writer with a PhD in psychology, and she's author of a new book called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer and psychologist Maria Konnikova. Her new book is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Maria, what are con artists looking for in a mark, in a victim?
Well, first of all, they are looking for someone who is going to be the best possible buyer of the story that they are selling. What I mean by that is there are different sorts of con artists. They're all, as we've discussed, storytellers. They are all people who are trying to sell an alternate reality for their own ends, but their stories differ and their skills differ, and they know their own skills very well. And so what they look for is the type of person who is ready to believe the specific thing that's their forte. One of the things that unites all victims is that they're in a very emotionally vulnerable point in their lives. And what I mean by that is that you have certain transitions that are happening in your lives. There's uncertainty going on. Maybe it's negative. You lost a job. Someone died. Maybe it's positive. You know, you just got a new job. You just got married. Maybe it's simply you're uprooted. You know, you've moved to a new city. You don't know anyone. Your support network is gone. Con artists can see that and they say, oh, I can sell you on lots of different things because you have some sort of a gaping need right now, and I can address that need. I can step in and give you meaning when you're really unmoored. And we really don't like feeling uncertain. We don't like that feeling of change. And we want the certainty that con artists are going to give us.
Some people enter our lives looking so much like victims that we instantly lower our guard and we would, you know, scold ourselves for asking any clarifying questions.
Absolutely. And a lot of con artists, one of them in particular that I write about in the book, know this incredibly well, and they take advantage of it. So the woman that I'm referring to, Samantha or Sammy Azzopardi, pulled off this incredible stunt where she ended up fooling the governments of three different countries consecutively. And what she would do is pretend to be a victim of sex trafficking. And she would show up. She did this in Ireland. She showed up completely just devastated, not speaking a word of English. She was actually Australian, but at this point, people thought that she was Eastern European or something else. They didn't know because she refused to speak English, but she drew pictures that depicted her as a victim. So what did the government do? Well, they deployed all resources available to them to try to find who this girl was. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on her, hundreds of man hours. Police were tracking down so many different leads. What did she get out of it? Well, she understood that no one questions a victim. No one is going to ask, hey, you know, Samantha, are you a con artist? People are going to feel absolutely terrible for this poor girl. And they're going to give her the attention and that sense of power that I think she craves. And so she ended up doing this not once, not twice, but three times when it came to governments. Canada and Australia were the other two victims.
And this is in the modern era of the internet. It's not as if this happened 50 years ago when it would be hard to, you know, send a photo out on Interpol.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, that's a really good point because we think that with the internet, all of these things are going to be a matter of history, that we won't be able to get the Ferdinand de Maras who conned the Navy. We won't be able to get the Samantha Azzopardis who cons the government of Ireland because people can check and technology protects us. And that is simply not true. And if anything, technology makes us more vulnerable because it opens up more tools to con artists to use. And so what ends up happening is we have a false sense of security. We think no one could possibly pull this off. And it ends up just perpetuating itself. I don't think there's any better illustration of that than the fact that the agency that did the security checks for a lot of the classified positions in the U.S. government, it ended up that a huge number of those security checks were fraudulent.
Sometimes when a con artist is talking, they're dropping information along the way that seems to be incidental, but in fact will get repeated later. And repeated exposure to a lie makes it seem more true, even if it's not.
Absolutely. There is something that Robert Zients, who was a famous cognitive psychologist of the 20th century, called the mere exposure effect, which means merely being exposed to something makes us like it more, makes us trust it more, makes us believe it more. And so he started out with simple things like melodies or like different letters and different fonts. And he found that people who heard things before, even if they weren't consciously aware of it, started liking those more, ranking those things more highly. But then you get to things like lies. And there's this phenomenal cognitive mechanism. Well, I don't know how phenomenal it is. It's actually pretty scary, where we are exposed to information, we might know at the time that it's not actually true, but we are going to remember the information and we're not necessarily going to remember that true false tag. And so we're going to like it more, we're going to feel comfortable around it, and we're going to trust it even though we should have, you know, alarm bells ringing. And that's a powerful thing that con artists absolutely love to use because it makes what they're saying that much more believable.
In an election season, what does that phenomenon say about our ability to believe things that start as rumors and somehow get entrenched in many people's minds as true, even when they've been proven demonstrably false?
Yeah, it does not bode well for those types of things. That's why rumors are so incredibly difficult to get people to just disbelieve. They're sticky because once we hear them, it's a worm. It worms its way into your mind and then it doesn't want to leave. We can try to, you know, get tweezers to get it out of there. And people do try. I mean, there are lots of campaigns that try to correct false information, but that first mover advantage is absolutely crucial. And so once it's out there, people just have it as part of their conscience. And unfortunately, this research really does not bode well for anyone who wants to set the record straight. It's why so many persistent myths and unscientific claims, not just political statements, end up feeding on themselves and self-perpetuating because one person says it, another person repeats it, and there you have it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Sherry is on the line in Tyler. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thank you for the subject. I had an interesting spin on it. I just wanted to say that I'm 52 now, but when I was 11, my father left. He basically abandoned the family for a better life, and it was very tumultuous for me. And I remember when, and my mother was not able to properly take care of me. And I remember back then being so juvenile that I went so far as I lived in a big city to, I think I could have been, very likely I could have become a con artist. Thankfully I didn't. But I went so far as to, I remember I put a fake cast on my leg, I think, or something, and I had some crutches, and I walked onto a bus with my, you know, I got a thrill out of people assuming that I had a broken leg.
Thank you so much for your call, Sherry. That's a really interesting story, Maria. Sherry talks about, like, the emotional thrill of convincing people of something that's not true.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that con artists experience. I spoke to a number of them while I was researching this book, and some of them, they're just gleeful. They not only are they not repentant, but they just get such a kick out of it, and they say, you know, suckers, they believed me. Can you believe that? And they actually, it's a wonderful feeling of power over other people. And it's really nice when people feel bad for us or when people respect us. There's so many different emotional paths we can take. And I think the thing that's in the middle of them is us. And we love when people pay attention to us. I think what Cherry was talking about, you can see why a young girl would do that if her parents are going through a rough time, if she's not getting any attention. Well, all of a sudden, she's once again the center of attention, which presumably she was before they broke up.
We all know that if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. But we all also believe that if anybody deserves something that's too good to be true, it is us.
That is absolutely true. And that is what gets us every single time. Because if something is happening to you, I can be very logical about it. And I say, oh, Chris, you know, that you really shouldn't believe that. That's really too good to be true. But right away, we don't question it when it happens to us. We say, oh, it's about time. I have been in so many horrible relationships for so many years. It's time for me to meet my Prince Charming and my Mr. Right. Isn't it wonderful that I finally met someone who can really, who really answers all of those needs? Or, you know, I've been investing in the stock market for so long. It's about time that all of my investments paid off. Yeah, sure, maybe a 40% a year return might seem high to you, but I'm just really savvy. I invest with the right people. You know, Bernie's a great guy.
We have an email here from David who says, I've talked with several people who have been conned in various ways. I've observed two common traits. First, they never question what they've been told. Second, they're motivated by greed, which blinds them to the risks.
I think that both of those things are actually false. It would be so nice to believe that people who are victims of con artists, first of all, aren't skeptical, and secondly, are greedy. So let's tackle the greed first, because I think it's a very common misperception. To illustrate why greed really has nothing to do with it, why it's much more about a deeper quest for meaning and for belief. Let's look at one of the most common scams, both on the internet and in the real world, which is the sweetheart scam, where somebody impersonates someone online and ends up drawing someone else into a relationship with them. So I've spoken to multiple people, often they're women, unfortunately, and often they're older women, and usually older women with some money because the scammer needs something out of it. And what ends up happening is they meet someone, let's say it's online, they develop a really deep relationship with them. This goes on over months, sometimes years, and they really feel like they know this person. They think that they're getting married. And slowly they drain their bank account because there's always a medical problem or they need help so that they can finally come visit them. And this goes on and on and on. And how is that being greedy? I mean, you are giving away all of your money. That's wanting love. That's wanting connection. That's wanting something very human, very basic, very fundamental. And that is, I think, the way that con artists operate. That's what they're tapping into. And people who are skeptical, by the way, that does not mean that you're not going to fall for a con. Even con artists fall for cons.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is proof of that.
Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Amar is on the line in Bedford. Hey, Amar.
Hi, Chris. Hi. I just had a question. I've been hearing what you guys are talking about, and these con artists, how they're really great at, you know, lying to people and getting people to believe them. But is it also possible that these con artists, you know, end up lying to themselves? Because I've seen many, you know, TED Talks on faking it till you believe it, and they're inspiring videos. And I'm just wondering how much of that can hold truth to what we're discussing right now.
Hmm. What do you think, Maria?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I do think that on some level, especially for some cons, con artists do have to drink their own Kool-Aid, so to speak. One of the ways that you can see this is in what I think of as kind of the con of all cons, the most serious, the most devastating, which are spiritual cons. These are cults. These are religious leaders who are not very good people and who actually end up conning their congregations. I think that in order to lead these movements, at some point, you have to actually believe what you're selling. Otherwise, other people aren't going to believe you. And so I think you go into it knowing exactly exactly what you're doing, knowing that it's about power, that it's about money, whatever it is that it's about for you. And then you end up saying it so many times that you really do start to live in that role. And you really do start being that guru rather than the con artist who is taking your entire cult for a ride.
Before we all start getting too depressed about, you know, really being sitting ducks for any con artist who might see us in their path, we've evolved to be really trusting because in most cases that actually serves us better than walking around with our guard up.
Absolutely. I was actually really surprised to discover how much research there has been on just how beneficial trust is. So on a social level, we know that societies with higher levels of generalized trust, and that's just kind of this trust in other people, they end up doing better economically. They have better infrastructures, better institutions. They are just much better developed socially. And that makes total sense because in order to communicate, in order to do business, in order to build lasting institutions, you do need to trust one another. If everyone is backstabbing and nobody can trust the next person, then nothing's going to get done. So that's on a broad social level. But on an individual level, it ends up that being more trusting is correlated with all sorts of things, from intelligence to happiness to health. So it's actually good to be a trusting person. You build stronger networks. You end up happier and doing better in life. And I think you made a very good point, Chris, about the fact that, you know, most people are not con artists. Okay. And it would really, really suck to go through life just never trusting anyone. I think you'd have a very cold and isolated existence.
One would think if you had the experience of being conned, it wouldn't happen to you again because you would know what to look for. But it has happened to some unfortunate individuals more than once.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it's not some, it's many. There's one particularly interesting one I write about in my book, Franklin Norfleet, who ends up falling for the same con by the same gang twice within 1 week because he thinks he was unlucky in an investment and that they made a mistake. And so he gives them first $20,000, which is his entire life savings, and then another $20,000 that he borrows from his family to kind of recoup his losses. And then he realized what happens and he ended up spending the rest of his life tracking down everyone who was involved. And by the way, this happened in Texas. And he was the little tiger of Hale County eventually because he was no longer the boomerang sucker. He'd figured it out.
My guest is writer Maria Konnikova. Her new book is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Maria Konnikova, a writer who also has a PhD in psychology. She's author of a book called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Maria, it's not our fault if we get conned, right? There is a criminal who is responsible for whatever losses we've incurred. But goodness, we feel so humiliated to be swindled that it works in the con artist to the con artist's advantage because we are really reluctant to tell the authorities.
Absolutely. And in fact, there are almost no reliable, actually, let me modify that. There are no reliable figures of how many people get conned a year because most cons, the vast majority, go unreported because people want to preserve their reputation. They don't want anyone else to know that they were a sucker, that they fell for something like this. And so they end up just staying quiet. And what happens to the con artist? Well, the con artist goes on to claim more and more victims because none of these victims end up reporting him. And the other part of it, the other reason why it's often unreported, is that sometimes people won't even admit to themselves that they've been conned. So they end up doing a con of sorts on their own minds. Mm. They rationalize it away and they say, oh, you know, it was just bad luck. You know, he really did have a family emergency and he had to leave to Cambodia. Or, you know, it really was just a bad gamble. You know, I took a risk and we lost. And we are so incredibly good at rationalizing and at reducing that sort of dissonance that exists between being conned and thinking ourselves as the type of person who can't get conned.
Does it help to be smart in terms of your risk of being conned? Does it hurt?
Unfortunately, not really. So there are people who have PhDs. One of the people I write about was a tenured physicist who ended up falling for one of those sweetheart scams that we were talking about. He thought that a supermodel was dating him. He ended up in jail for smuggling cocaine in South America because obviously that was not a supermodel. And that was not a romantic relationship. He did not know. So obviously he's someone with a very high IQ. But even people who are very savvy, people who are detectives might end up falling for con artists. And it really depends on the type of fraud. So there are some organizations that try to figure out, well, what do victims look like? Unfortunately, they don't have very good profiles, but they can tell you that there are different types of scams that will appeal to different sorts of people. So, for instance, investment scams, being smart hurts you because the smarter you are, the more likely you are to give money to someone like Bernie Madoff. But if it's something like a sweepstakes scam, you know, one of those things that you get in the mail where they really expect only a few people to answer, a lot of times those are people who aren't as educated, who sometimes never finished high school. Basically, those people fit much more that profile that we associate with victims of con artists. But that's just one very, very specific type of scam.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hello. I've noted that you said that some of the con artists felt a real rush when their stories were believed, like an addiction. Are you aware of any attempts to psychologically treat con artists to deal with what they're doing?
Interesting question.
It is an interesting question. And as far as I know, no, because so many of them, they are quite different. I don't actually think it is an addiction in the sense that they can't stop doing it. For them, it's a profession. It's a way of life. And it's actually a lot of work. And if they put that much energy into anything else, I think they would be incredibly successful. What we do know is that some con artists, like Frank Abagnale, who you might know from Catch Me If You Can, that made his story quite famous, end up being rehabilitated and they end up consulting for law enforcement. So Abagnale, for multiple decades now, has been working with the FBI and other law enforcement organizations to help catch other fraudsters. So that's not necessarily psychological counseling, but it is some sort of a rehabilitation program that allows con artists to still use those same deceptive thought patterns, but put them to better use.
After you have been scammed, or even after you've watched a movie about a scam, it's remarkable how evident those red flags are that you just don't see the first time around.
Absolutely. And I think that's, for some people, the most difficult part to understand. They look at victims and they say, how could you not have seen those red flags? I mean, you were willfully blind. But if you are actually in that situation, you're already emotionally involved. This is your story. It's not something abstract that you can distance yourself from. And so when a red flag presents itself, it's invisible to you. It's not a red flag. You know, even if you start seeing it and someone say, hey, you know, red flag, it's waving, you say, oh, no, no, it's kind of pink and it's not actually a flag. It's, you know, a handkerchief that someone dropped. You really... just dismiss the evidence rather than dismiss the story. And people do this all the time. There are cases where they're presented with evidence that the people they're dealing with are con artists. There's this guy, Oscar Hartzell, who for many, many years conned people into believing that Sir Francis Drake had left behind this huge treasure and they'd become millionaires if only they invested in the fight to free the Drake fortune from the British bureaucracy. And he was caught finally, and he was brought to trial. And even still, his victims refused to give him up. And they said, no, 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 you know, we believe him. These are not red flags. This actually feeds right into the story he was telling us. It's all a big conspiracy, and you're bringing him to trial because you don't want us to have our money. So you tell yourself all these stories, and you just don't see the things that to other people are obvious.
Let's speak next on the phone to Jeremy in Dallas. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. I'm a writer here in Texas, and I finished a screenplay recently about Frank Northfleet. And a movie screenplay, and I got interested in writing it because I do write history, but also because of the way that Mr. Northfleet, he was very skeptical, and he was a very smart man, and he was still con, like you said, not only once but twice. And the other thing that interested me was his reaction to it. At the time, during that era in the 1920s, or in 1920 when this happened, you know, the typical reaction was dejection, and they wouldn't even report it to the police, and sometimes even suicide. And I was just wondering what your comment might be on his reaction and the reaction that he took in actually even pursuing some of these people down for other people that were conned. There was a family in an elderly couple in Florida that he helped out during his time.
Thanks for your call, Jeremy, and I hope your movie gets picked up, and I'd love to see it someday.
Yeah, so I think Jeremy raises a very interesting point, which is that Northfleet really is an exceptional individual because he not only admitted that he was conned, but he was a strong enough person who then went after all of these different con artists. And that is so remarkably rare that I'd be hard-pressed to tell you five stories like that. I can't even find three off the top of my head, just because that really takes a strength of character to not only admit that you were a sucker. I mean, nobody wants to make that admission. And so you have to do that. You have to say, yes, I was a sucker. And then you also have to expend all of this energy on trying to bring people to justice, even without the way that he went about it, which was actually trying to track all of these people down. And back then, you know, you didn't have all of the resources that you have today. But even today, when you have law enforcement, there's just so many hurdles that a lot of people say, you know what, I'm just going to give up. So I think he was an exceptional individual. And I don't think we can generalize from that, because most victims would never do that.
How do you convince people who have been conned to talk to you for a book that will enter the permanent record?
A lot of them would talk to me only anonymously. Mm-hmm. And I think that they wanted their stories out there because they wanted other people to benefit from them. But they still did not want to be associated with it. But a few were willing to go on the record. And I think for them, it was a matter of having lived with this for a long enough time that they realized how important it was to share this, and so that people would know who this was coming from, so that people would realize, hey, you know, the person telling this story is not just an honest, upright citizen, but is someone who I know, someone I trust, someone like me. And if someone who's exactly like me, who's my next door neighbor, can fall for it, then maybe I can as well. Because once you have a name, once a person comes forward publicly, it becomes much more difficult to deny the fact that we're all possible victims, in the same way that you can if it's someone who you don't know and someone who's kind of more anonymous, just kind of a faceless person out there. That then it's very easy to say, oh, but that person's nothing like me.
Did you learn anything about the dynamic among teams of con artists? Because it seems like that's a whole other level. It's one thing to be sort of able to do this sort of thing yourself. It's another thing to convince partners to go in on it with you.
Absolutely. And a lot of con artists do work in teams. And what I found was that it's a play. And there's the lead con artist who's the playwright, and he scripts everything and he gives everyone their roles, and everyone has a very specific character that they have to play. Otherwise, the con will fall apart and won't actually come to fruition. And so you end up seeing just these dramas that are often acted out over weeks for the benefit of one single person. And it's crazy to me. You would think, well, these people deceive others for a living. How can they trust each other? How can they think that everything is going to go right? And I'm actually surprised at how often they do trust each other and they do pull this off and they work together for a long time. In movies, we always see something going wrong. And so you get the impression that these teams of con artists will often, you know, there'll be someone who turns on them. There'll be some off dynamic. But there are actually a lot of incredibly successful teams out there who have built. It's so funny. It's this irony that they have such strong trust among themselves, and yet when it comes to everyone else, they just take advantage of them.
Let's very quickly go to the phones one more time. We have Steve on the line in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Chris. Really enjoy your program, but. What you were talking about is kind of what happened to me. I got involved with it started out just giving a guy a ride and ended up being this whole elaborate deal. But what I wanted to tell you about was, and I wasn't conned, but the thing is it required me to want something they have, and all my life it heard you can't cheat an honest man, and I don't consider myself honest Dave or anything, but I just didn't, you know, it's just I didn't want the money. I didn't want the shortcut. You know, I was just like, I didn't want to help you. And it turned out, you know, they finally quit after about 40. And it's embarrassing that I let it go on. I think it'd still be going on. I'd still be trying to help them. But in any case, I just want to get, you know, I'll take your comments out there. Thanks.
Thanks for your call, Steve. Well, to finish this out, Maria, is there something that you've learned, maybe Steve did, about how we can recognize that maybe we're being groomed for a con and get ourselves out before it's too late?
Well, I think the one thing that we can really tell ourselves is if it seems too good to be true, it really, really is. There's no such thing as seems. And the other thing is there's also no such thing as the exception to the rule. Huh. Rules are rules for a reason. And so if we see something that's out of the odd, that seems really wonderful, a stranger who's suddenly our best friend, you know, that's a huge red flag. And even though we might want to believe them, I think we need to start upping our skepticism and asking questions. And that's easier to do in situations like the one we just heard, where they very clearly are after something financial. But it's easier said than done in a situation like Samantha as a party. What are you going to do when a victim comes up to you? Are you going to refuse them sympathy? So I think that these are all questions that we need to grapple with. Sometimes even when we know we're being conned or when we strongly suspect we're being conned, it's just better to go along with it because we'll feel better at the end of it rather than running the risk of being a terrible human being who refused to believe a true story.
Have you ever found a fictional con story that is better than some of the real life ones that you've looked into?
That's a really good question, and the answer is no. I have not found a writer who can create anything that is nearly as improbable as the cons that I encountered. I mean, even Dan Brown would be hard-pressed to do it. There's a guy in France, Thierry Tilly, who over several years ended up convincing a family of wealthy French aristocrats that they were the target of this intricate Masonic plot, and they ended up getting rid of their chateau, all of their money, and they ended up as menial laborers in England. And, you know, tell me a novel that can beat that.
Maria Konnikova is a writer with a PhD in psychology. Her new book is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.